Welcome to the Fast Forward podcast, powered by Futureworld. We live in an incredibly challenging, interesting, and for many, somewhat scary times. The world is changing at a speed that is unprecedented. One of our guests on the podcast, who I'll introduce just now, refers to it often as mind-boggling in almost every single dimension. Corporations, CEOs, leaders, ordinary human beings are finding it incredibly challenging to think about how we cope with these changes that are happening in the world. This podcast will seek to introduce to you new metaphors, help you understand the complexity, and frame five very different and challenging mental models to help you navigate through these uncertain and yet exciting waters, filled with opportunities I believe we have not seen in our lifetime almost. However, the truth is that leaders need to think completely differently, develop entirely new mental models to understand the nuances of these new changes that are taking place in our world. In fact, one of the fundamentals will be for leaders to stop looking at trends, which of course exist today. What really becomes incredibly critical in this new environment is for leaders to become attuned to the signals which the future is sending us. Signals that tell us a story, signals that are loud and strong and obvious, connecting and combining with signals that are maybe weak and tiny and seemingly insignificant. These combinations are creating brand new markets, establishing and demanding, in fact, brand new business models. And the question is, how do companies relate to these and how do we go forward? I am Anton Musgrave, a founder of Futureworld International. My background started really as a commercial lawyer in private practice. And it was in 1989 that a signal happened across my desk that suggested the world of communication would profoundly and fundamentally change. That small signal way back in the late 1980s was none other than what we know today as the internet. Of course, it wasn't called that in those days. But the signal suggested that how we communicate, how we share information, how we collaborate across all industries would fundamentally shift. That triggered a curiosity in my mind that said, what else is out there shaping the future that I'm blissfully unaware of as I bill my hours and count my minutes and extract money from my clients, not always from adding value, but simply from selling minutes. And that was the realization that started my journey into looking towards the future, learning from the future rather than observing the past, to try and establish how one can stay relevant and deliver value to the marketplace and to clients in that world. In that journey into the future, I had the fortune of meeting the two gentlemen who I will now introduce. With me in the studio is Louis Hering. Louis was an auditor. He was the managing partner of Deloitte Consulting for many, many years, responsible for their global innovation initiatives way back in order to make sure that professional services stayed ahead of the game and stayed relevant. From then, Louis moved into the world of private equity, exciting, challenging, and again, triggered in him a passion to seek future relevant value and to understand deeply from a financial, from a commercial, and from a leadership perspective, how businesses can succeed in the future. Our second guest is a renowned award-winning futurist from Switzerland, Gerd Lenhard. He's known for all his work on the good future, how to understand the shifts in the world profoundly, and how to make choices in our daily lives and in our businesses that will assure a better future, not only for the planet, but most importantly, perhaps also for humanity. And what we want to do today is really talk about these new mental models that we can use with CEOs and say, how do we understand this complexity, this uncertainty, if you like? The first of those that we'll introduce is called, interestingly, the Cassandra Complex. Now, Louis, perhaps you'd like to give us a short summary of what this theme called the Cassandra Complex might mean.
So in Greek mythology, Cassandra was cursed to see the future but never be believed. And I think executives today face the inverse curse. They're drowning in predictions about disruption, but they can't distinguish prophecy from noise. And I think ultimately, if one were to think through this particular point, it really comes down for me, do you have the conviction to act on what you see, even when the world calls you crazy?
Yeah.
And I think there are many, many examples that have distinguished incredibly successful companies over the years that have been able to do that, not just once or two times or three times, but as a continuous evolution.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think we must also sketch this in the background of the mortality rate of companies increasing at an unprecedented rate. I mean, the forecast is if you're on an S&P 500 company, that by 2027, it'll be down to 12 years average lifespan on an index like the S&P 500.
So these are top global companies with very competent senior leadership, well-experienced, successful, obviously, to get into the index in the first place, and yet just unable to stay relevant.
Correct. Now, imagine the most successful companies on the planet. These are not companies that are poor in talent, capital, or any of those factors that typically drive successful organizations. They are endowed with all of those.
Amazing.
But yet they get displaced. It's the yin and the yang concept. On the one end, you can be disrupted.
Yes.
The other side of the coin is, why wouldn't you disrupt others? And I think the point is, if you are able, as part of a business process, able to disrupt others on a continuous basis, you will not disappear off these indices.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think just one great example for me at the moment is, for example, what MicroStrategy has done. I mean, becoming a Bitcoin treasury business. You know, long before anybody else actually believed it, they embarked on this journey, which has resulted in extraordinary value and market capitalization increase way beyond their Bitcoin treasury holdings.
And of course, globally dominant at a speed that makes it very difficult for others to catch up.
Correct. And they've been able to combine their core business of software also with
into that framework.
That little signal of decentralized finance and cryptocurrency.
Fascinating. Good. I'm curious to hear from your perspective. And as I've said, you often reflect on the world we're living in and use the word mind-boggling, which I've stolen with impunity, I have to tell you, because I think it captures the essence of the craziness that we're going through in the world right now. So in your experience, Gerd, just share with us a few thoughts on how you think leaders need to respond and react and think in, as you say, the mind-boggling future.
So there's really two things. One is Barbara Marx Hubbard, you know, famous futurist. She said the future exists first in imagination, then in will, and then in reality. So the future does not exist in intellectual effort initially. Intellectual effort is now a commodity. I mean, we're now at a point to where first computing became a commodity. So computing is very cheap now, and if you do a lot of it, it's very expensive, but it has gotten substantially cheaper. And now intelligence is becoming a commodity. I mean, let's be frank, you know, you can go to ChatGPT or Gemini, you can ask about the future of Switzerland, where I live, and we'll give you a nice little talk, even make up a voice and a podcast. And so what is the difference to us? The difference is we don't just need intelligence, we also need understanding, intuition, imagination, you know, the human things, emotions. And how can you tell a good story without emotions? You could fake it, of course, right? So I think this is the important part, is to realize first we have imagination, then we want something, we have a vision, and then we create the reality. And in Europe, you know, I'm from Germany originally, we have this problem that we always are looking for the reality to actually move on it. So when it's real, then we say, okay, it's proven. And that's not how it works today. We can't prove the future by taking a deeper look at the facts. There's no such thing. Now it's really about vision, storytelling, understanding, intuition, imagination, as it always has been, but now it's even better or worse, you could say, because AI does the facts.
It's very interesting, Gerd, that you know, for leaders to be successful, they almost need to embrace the unthinkable. I think it was Arthur C. Clarke in 1965 who said, unless your view of the future is thoroughly unbelievable, you will have no chance of success. Which is really scary for CEOs when they're facing a panel of analysts and investors and shareholders. But nonetheless, I think the lesson from the Cassandra complex is that in this exciting, new and very different world, a new concept has become incredibly important for leaders. And that is the ability to tell a story about the ambition, let's call it the dream, a word not often spoken about in MBA lectures. What is the dream of the organization, and what will that dream mean for everybody in the entire world and ecosystem? And be able to tell that story with such conviction, passion, insight, and aspiration that, in fact, it leaves the audience with goosebumps. Goosebumps of excitement, trepidation perhaps to some extent, but nonetheless a commitment to do whatever it takes to go and achieve the impossible, the unthinkable, the insightful from the dream perspective. And just trust that the process that will evolve, which we'll talk about a bit later on in the podcast, in fact, will validate the ambition subsequently. But incredibly important to start with that goosebump moment of say, wow, imagine if we could do A, B, C, or D. Let's move on to our second mental model that is critically important for organizations to succeed in the tumultuous future that awaits all of us. And we call this the boiling frog paradox. Now, coming from a part of the world that I do, we're quite used to this. We sublimely and perhaps unwittingly move forward each day, just believing that the future will be good, ignoring perhaps some of the signs around us that they're deep and challenging issues to be resolved. And so we expect the world to continue at the slow speed of yesterday, ignoring the fact that speed is escalating almost exponentially. And so how does one, Gerd, think about some of these sort of ice breaks, if you like, that are happening around us? And how do we prepare ourselves for that moment of truth when we realize that we were ignoring the obvious?
Well, I mean, I think it's really a character skill. You know, it's the ability to observe. And I've noticed with many of my clients is that if they are successful, they stop observing, right? Because they start repeating, because it has always worked. And some of the German car companies are great examples for this, right? And the future is not a repetition of the present. It's not an extension of today. It is completely different. Sometimes you're lucky and it becomes an extension. But generally speaking, it's different. I was in the music business. We sold records. And today we sell, air or what, the click on the phone, right? And it's just not the same. So if you are a good observer, you will notice things and you will say, that's interesting. You know, maybe that's against my assumption. So two things I always tell people. First, let's get better at observing what's happening around us and spend, as Bill Gates says, 1 hour per day in the future. And I'm not talking about Netflix here. I'm talking about reading good stuff. And then the second is we have to question our assumptions. We're just assuming too many things. You know, for example, we had the assumption for a long time that basically electric vehicles won't work because you'll never get more than 50 miles, to take one. And now we're at 500, right? So the assumptions are really what kind of creates a problem, because we have these fixed things that we say, okay, that's it. The world is like this. But turns out if we're observing, we can have our assumption disrupted, which is good.
Yeah, yeah. And it happens really, really quickly. Louis, from your perspective, you know, as a private equity specialist, shall we say, you must have observed many industries and companies that have just kind of missed things because they embedded really in operating today and not looking for some of these shifts that are taking place around them. And so they wake up one morning and someone sort of changed the game on their watch.
Yeah, I must say it doesn't happen overnight, though.
Yes.
I mean, the point is the signals were clear for years, perhaps even decades.
Mm.
But you see companies cling to a particular business model, an operating protocol, a strategy. And if I can just have my sword out for 1 second, I think in the modern organization, boards have a lot to answer to in terms of the demise of companies.
Mm.
Because boards are overly fixated with keeping the CEO in their lane. The definition of core business, as you know, Anton, is a particular bugbear of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Because companies defined their core business at one point in time with relevance to a market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But of course, what happens over time, markets move.
Mm-hmm.
But companies cling to this narrow definition.
Yes.
And as we all know, the magic is happening at the intersect of industries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think this boiling frog paradox is certainly one that I think has got a massive impact on companies. If you're not aware of over time the changes. Let's get a great example. In the mobile telecoms business, do we really think this drug called dependency on data revenue is going to remain?
Yeah.
Are we going to be paying for data anywhere in the world in 10 years' time or in 15
Correct.
Years' time?
Yeah.
Whilst the world is being wrapped with this digital skin by Starlink and others, are we really going to have telcos? Mm. Another one which is a great example for me of late is what has happened to the advertising industry. I don't know if you've
Absolutely.
Probably seen
yeah.
the rug has been pulled out of
overnight.
The advertising industry overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't something that happened, you know, in the last few months. Mm. It came for a long period of time. Were these advertising companies willing to make the necessary investment to start changing their business models to ensure that they get value from the scarcest resource, which is creativity, which
yes.
AI can't necessarily give you?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
to capitalize on that.
Interesting. I think it was Sir Ernest Hemingway who said, how did you go insolvent? And his answer was gradually and then suddenly. And I think that, for me, captures the essence of the boiling frog paradox. Is these things appear to happen suddenly, but in fact, they've been happening to you gradually over time. So, folks, the second takeaway from our boiling frog paradox metaphor, if you like, is for leaders to really be alert to the cracks in the ice cap that are sort of forming underneath our feet and react to them and respond to them and prepare for them before they impact on us in a very negative fashion. We will, in subsequent podcasts, as part of the Fast Forward podcast series powered by Future World, we will bring you deep dive conversations about each of these in much greater depth with some more practical examples, more practical tips on how to cope. But for now, let's focus on our third metaphor, the Ptolemaic, if I've pronounced that correctly, pivot. Now, this is a very interesting process, folks, as it talks about how one simply pads or adds to the way one has always done things, or how we go about our business, or what we believe our business value proposition to be. And we assume that by adding process, adding features, perhaps, our future will be guaranteed. And of course, we mistake this patchwork of additions, patchwork of new layers for progress. And so how do we respond to this? Louis, your thoughts on the Ptolemaic pivot as our third mental model?
So of course, for 1400 years, astronomers followed Ptolemy's Earth-centered model, whereby the Earth was in the center and all the planets, the sun, the moon, revolved around the Earth. And of course, Copernicus proved it wrong.
And some CEOs now, still think the world revolves around
well,
them and their company,
my point.
Right?
This is my point. This is exactly, you stole my thunder now, Anton. But it's not only that, by the way. I think it's also a question of some companies not realizing that they're orbiting the wrong star.
Yeah.
Okay. And apropos our discussion earlier, where we discussed this definition of core business, is it actually potentially as simple as being open, having a culture of openness to adapt, to understand, to endorse, to bring in these new concepts, to properly investigate them, see what is relevant, see what will work, what won't work, and to use that and to do that on a consistent basis. I think I'm keen on what Gerd's view on this would be, but if I, in conclusion from my side, I just want to say perhaps we could have also said this, the arrogance challenge.
Yes, yes, indeed. It's Gerd, let's hear from you.
Yeah, I think, you know, as I said earlier, this is really about the assumptions, you know, that you have, what you assume to be correct. And so there are religious, societal, practical, physical, scientific assumptions. Like, you know, many scientists that I meet and that I work with in the past, you know, their assumption is that they should be free to invent and whatever it is that they're inventing. And in the end, somebody else will take charge of it, right? And that's how we got to Oppenheimer. And that's why we should not have a Manhattan Project for AI, because it's not just about inventing. And those are the assumptions. I mean, and how do your assumptions get disturbed? Well, you know, from a marriage, you know, that your assumptions get disturbed when somebody says, you know what, you're just not paying attention. I've had enough. Right. And that's how your assumptions get disturbed. And in business, you drive against the wall. Your assumption has proven to be invalid. Look at Nokia, right? And other companies, your assumptions has proven invalid. Like, we'll never have a phone with a touch screen and so on and so on. in all the, like, you know, it, and then if you have like a whole slew of assumptions, you know, several in a row, it gets very dangerous because no matter what you do, your assumption says, no, we can't do that, right? And so to free yourself from assumption, it's a great exercise to sit down and say, let me write down what I believe is the truth about my business and about my life. Because let's be fair, in the end, this is a character skill. You know, if you're a closed person, you will be a closed CEO. And we have to work on that. I think that is the crucial part, is we have to change our own assumptions about how everything works, especially now with AI. You know, we have all these assumptions about what we are, what it is.
And I think what that's doing, Gerd, is to say to us, what is, you know, what is the simplest form in which we can describe our value proposition? You know, what comes to my mind is Microsoft's Excel, for example. I was told once, and I've never been able to validate this, but there are only a handful of people on an A4 page locked away in a vault in Cupertino, a list of people that use more than 35% of Excel's features. And of course, they don't want that to become public because, you know, what Excel has done is, of course, is added complexity, added layers, the assumption that everyone is using all of these tools and that will keep us relevant. But in fact, the simple realization needs to be, what are the basics that we're providing and what are customers really paying us additional value for? And at some point, they'll wake up and realize the complexity that they've assumed is necessary was never necessary in the first place. And perhaps AI is going to make us realize that, I think, in quite a few industries.
You meant Seattle, not Cupertino. You are such an ardent Mac fan.
I have to concede I am. Our fourth mental model is the lighthouse keeper's dilemma. And I'm reminded of a few jokes relating to lighthouses. The one is the captain of a massive big aircraft carrier who gets a message to say, aircraft carrier, please change your course. And the captain says, no, I am the huge ship XYZ by name, and I won't change my course, you change yours. And of course, this banter carries on until the lighthouse keeper says, well, it's entirely up to you what decision you make. I'm a lighthouse, your choice. But nonetheless, folks, moving forward, good. The lighthouse really is, you know, the concept is the metaphor, the story around that is, its function is to warn, its value proposition is to warn, of course, for navigational safety. But how that's done in the advent of technology, GPS signals, for example, has fundamentally changed. And the question is, how do organizations need to see that their fundamental purpose might remain valid and compelling and valuable, but how they deliver that, the business model behind that profoundly changes? Some thoughts from you on that.
I think it's very hard to see from the inside. And that's even true for our own jobs. You know, as we are changing because AI is changing what we do, it's very hard to change it from the inside. Sometimes it's better if you're capable of stepping out and, you know, and to kind of live in two worlds. You have today and you have to execute today, and then you have tomorrow. If you can switch back and forth, you know, then you have a good model. And I think in technology, you see some leaders like Tim Cook, you know, who can do that. Mm-hmm. And you see other leaders, you know, who cannot do that. And then they get stuck, like in the car industry. So to be able to look at today and execute and then say, you know, maybe tomorrow there will not be an iPhone. Maybe there will be another interface. And, you know, Johnny Ive just stepped out and said, okay, the next thing is not going to be a device. It's going to be a device of a different sort, right? Yeah. So I think to be able to step out, that's the important part. And this is also, again, it's a skill that you have to practice and to learn. And unfortunately, I think one of the major drivers of this is that the stock market doesn't reward this kind of dual track thinking, you know, in two mindsets, you know, it rewards execution, which is fine. But it, you know, we're 20 years behind in what the stock market wants as to what we really need. And this is a major challenge for us to actually innovate based around all the mega shifts that we're seeing today, from AI to quantum computing to synthetic biology and so on. You know, we have to think of this in a different context, and not just in the context of that.
It becomes really important for leaders to understand, operate successfully, of course, their business of today. I mean, that's what rewards shareholders in the short term, provides relevance, etc. But the compelling requirement is for them at the same time, concurrently, and this is difficult because they're often contradictory, is to contemplate and imagine the business of tomorrow. And of course, to do that simultaneously. And of course, the higher you move up the leadership chain, the more your time investment needs to pivot from the today operations into the tomorrow's world.
And we haven't really seen organizations do that in-house very much. Most of that happens outside. You know, the music industry was not innovated by the music guys and, you know, by Clive Davis. It was innovated by Apple and then by Spotify and on and on and on it goes. So if that is the case in your industry, if you're in the pharma industry today, you know, the pharma of the future is about technology. And you have to look at those guys and bring them in. And that's how you innovate. That's how you do it, right?
And I think the trap that we fall into, Louis, and I'm keen to hear your comment, is, you know, leaders understand, or most leaders should understand very clearly what the core assumptions are that make their current business successful. And the question is, which of those core assumptions remain valid in the future? And if all you're focusing on is those that are relevant today, and you're not questioning which of them become toxic at some point in the future, you're going to be caught in the entirely wrong playing field. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So just coming back to the metaphor, this lighthouse keeper's dilemma, of course, lighthouses were displaced by GPS.
Yes.
Ships have GPS. They know the depth of the oceans that they're traveling on. So that was displaced. So I think the metaphor for executives really in this instance is the question every executive should ask. It's not how do I keep my lighthouse running, but how do I ensure safe passage?
Yes.
In any weather?
Yep.
Okay. And that comes back to the point you made around the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't want us to lose that point around purpose.
Mm.
You know, a purpose statement is for me the most important element of any business. I hate vision, mission, strategy, or all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But purpose endures. The purpose statement asks, why do people get up in the morning to do why do they come to work to do what they want to do? And this is this lighthouse keeper's dilemma.
I think exactly that. It's the lighthouse keeper, what they did and how they did it shifted, but why they were there in the first place never
remained.
Shifted.
Some examples, Walt Disney's purpose statement is to make people happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Sony, in its early formative years, was to change the perception of Japanese poor quality.
Yes.
That was Sony's purpose statement.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So there are many, many companies and also ones that we see, successful companies today. And I want to say, if you look at the S&P 500, any major index, Fortune 500, I think without fail, you would be hard-pressed not to find a very, very clear purpose of the top-performing companies. And I would think purpose and companies that you would generally regard and read about as innovative businesses go hand in hand.
Absolutely.
They are one and the same.
Absolutely correct.
Because they innovate by fulfilling their purpose, not by clinging to a core business, not by being a lighthouse.
And not being a victim, if you like, or prisoner to those narrow definitions and being willing to explore. So folks, there we have it, our fourth mental model. Our next and final one to introduce to you as an introduction to the series of the Future Forward podcast brought to you by Future World is to think about Darwin's finches. Now, I had the personal privilege as one of my bucket list items in my life to spend a few weeks in the islands that Darwin sort of did his research on, the Galapagos Islands. And it was fascinating to understand firsthand in front of me how these finches were able to evolve in some cases and stay relevant as a species despite the changing environment around them. So the story about Darwin's finches really, folks, is about how do specialists become adaptive generalists and how do they not be trapped by their deep specializations so narrowly defined that they just miss again the shifts in this mind-boggling world that we're moving into in the future. Gerd, your thought, have you been able to visit the Galapagos, Gerd, and see this adaptation firsthand and other stories you might bring to explain to our listeners what this might mean for them as leaders in our new world?
Well, I have not been to the Galapagos. I would love to. But of course, in that example, you know, I've been doing this for 23 years or something, and I have many examples of how companies fall into that trap of not being able to adapt to the sort of evolution. You know, let's be honest, you know, right now we have the biggest evolution in humankind since the internet, really, or electrification, which is the rise of intelligent machines. Intelligent parenthesis, but nevertheless, a huge disruption is now general purpose technology. And a lot of companies don't realize what that means to their work and their workers and the products and the fact that knowledge is now a commodity and intelligence becoming a commodity of a sort. You know, what exactly will all that mean? And I think this is now, this is the time where we need to think about what actually is the differentiator between us and the machines, right? And this is the key question that will also change markets completely because markets will use AI as well. So very, very big topic is to be able to actually become something different. Again, I think it's a character skill. You know, if you can do that in your own life, you can probably do it with your company if you have enough power over it. Yeah. So it's something we have to practice. And unfortunately, I think we learned at business school. I didn't go to business school, but many of us learned at business school certain crafts and skills and models, and you know, and then we rinse and repeat, right? And this is not how it works anymore. Now it's basically the opposite. So what we've learned there has become sort of the back in the back mirror, you know, it's fading away very quickly. Right. Well, we're going faster and faster.
It's the neuroplasticity that we experience, right? As we grow, as we become more experienced, as we become successful, of course, we think that that's the way to do it. That's the way we should always do it. And I often somewhat humorously, Louis, say to people, you know, just do me a favor. And when you have your next shower, just wash your body in a different sequence. And I guarantee you some important body part will be left out of the process because, you know, we're so trained to think along certain specific lines, certain routines that we do off-pat without challenging them, without thinking about them. And so this ability to shift, and of course it's tempered by the fact that we want to do everything absolutely perfectly, right? With zero risk attached to it. And of course that mitigates against actually being able to adapt and to change. And so these, our neuro sort of memory muscles just are so embedded in certain ways. How have you experienced that in your life?
So firstly, let me just say, Gerd, my already high aspiration of you is just increased by the fact that you didn't go to business school. But in any event, I want to, in fact, respond with a question, Anton. And this is, of course, Darwin's Finch's effect, of course, happened over a very long period of time.
Yes, yes.
And it was... The Finches were required to adapt.
And could, because they had the time to do so.
And the time to do so.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, this is a little bit opposite to the time frame in a corporate sense that companies have today.
Correct. Yes.
So how do we deal with that? If you don't have time, how do you respond to Darwin's Finches effect if you don't have the time?
People argue the change has been there throughout the ages, right? But what we're seeing is the cycle of change, the product life cycle relevance, the R&D life cycles are shortening dramatically all the time. And of course, it's compounded by the speed of technological change. But the single reason for the speed of sort of escalating to the extent that it does is one simple word. It's called connectivity. Now, connectivity is driven by what's now become today instant, real-time, zero latency, everything. So speed is a commodity. Adaptability becomes just a requirement. We shouldn't even be talking about it. It should be like oxygen, right?
Correct.
And so the question is, how do we build optionality into our plans, our strategies, and our thinking? How do we look at alternatives that are quicker and easier to do? And of course, how do we shift away from this need to be absolutely perfect? How do we not follow global best practice? I mean, global best practice has been taught in business schools as the one of the yardsticks by which you measure whether what you're doing is acceptable or not. And yet, global best practice, when you implement it, is 3, 6, 9, 12 months old already. The world's moved on.
So maybe the Darwin effect is realizing you don't have time.
Absolutely. That's the critical question. And folks, let me just tell you that when I worked with a Chinese bank recently, they implement an idea in a meeting that is then rolled out into their business network in 36 hours. Every single new idea, that is speed. And of course, the rest of us take weeks and months. So folks, there we have it. Our first podcast in this series. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations, the provocations, the new mental models, if you like. Let me just remind you, folks, there are 5 new mental models. In the rest of the series, we will be unpacking each of these in much more detail with some granular examples, if you like. In the rest of the series, we'll be bringing you insights from other speakers from around the world with deep subject matter expertise, to challenge you, to excite you, to hopefully get you to formulate a new dream, a new ambition for yourself, for your family, for your children, and of course, for your business, your shareholders, and your investors. Please join us as signal finders from the future. Share this with those around you, spread the word, and let's create a global movement of leaders more acutely aware of the demands to stay relevant, stay valuable, and stay hopeful for our future. Gerd from Lugano in Switzerland, great having you on the podcast. Thank you very much. Louis Hering, great to have you with you, be with you in the studio. And so to everyone who joined us in this first episode of the podcast series, Fast Forward, brought to you and powered by Future World, thank you very much for joining us today. And watch for the signals for our next podcast in this exciting series.